It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's just dive right in because there's a ton of stuff to cover. It was compared to a couple of the previous weeks, it was actually somewhat busy this week.
Yeah, that's a reasonable assumption. Yeah.
All right.
You're doing well so far.
All right.
I guess we'll keep you.
Yeah, unfortunately, you don't have much choice.
This is also true.
So let's talk about economic issues that affect the whole country, starting with Medicare. Things aren't looking so good for Medicare.
Well, and it really harkens back to the original premise of our national healthcare system, which is that the best way to deal with healthcare in this country is not to get sick. And that was supposed to be fixed. The great promise by both Republican and Democratic candidates, for that matter, in 2000 was that they would fix our healthcare system. And we waited and we waited and we waited. And finally, President Bush pushed through his Medicare bill this past spring over a divided Congress. And as in the wake of that bill being passed, and this is kind of something that has been a hallmark of the Bush administration, that it's only after bills pass, whether it's the Patriot Act or, I mean, whatever it is, that the unsavory details of what is now law begin to leak out. The first unsavory detail is that among all the ballooning deficits of our supposed fiscal conservative that's in the White House, that was a joke for anybody who's wondering about the missing laugh track. That the actual cost to the federal government of the Medicare bill, which was presented to Congress by the White House as being $305 billion, that's B as in billion, the actual cost, as the economists are now calculating, is going to be something more like $574 billion, nearly twice. It's, you know, like 42-43%. Higher cost. That cost, as people will recall, because we talked about it when this bill was up for passage, one-third of every dollar that's being spent on this bill is going directly into the pockets of the drug companies in terms of increased profit for them, what is already the most profitable business in America.
And another large portion is going into the pockets of private insurance companies.
Yeah. By the time you get to the actual people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this bill, a number of seniors and disabled people who are now on Medicare who do not receive any kind of support for prescription drugs, which have been, the cost has been going up in double-digit numbers, even though inflation has been nowhere near that. The cost has been going up that way for really most of the last decade. Seniors are discovering that what has happened essentially is that, yeah, there's a drug benefit now that comes with Medicare, but the deal with the devil that it involves is that Medicare is being essentially privatized, and that the cost that they will have to pay out to their insurers for these plans is going to be astronomical. It's going to be unaffordable for most people on fixed incomes. And that means not only that the drug benefit will be unaffordable for a lot of people, but even the basic coverage that they now get under Medicare is going to be unaffordable in the same way. So it really is, this was supposed to be a centerpiece of the Bush reelection campaign.
Well, and then there's the coverage gap as well. People who can afford the premiums will have the coverage. However, the coverage won't cover what they think it will. So when they start spending, paying for their prescriptions, there's going to be a large portion of their prescriptions that won't be covered at all under this deal.
Yeah, and whereas you have a whole cottage industry now of what is called supplemental policies, you know, that are issued to people on Medicare because they don't actually get covered for important parts of people's medical costs. That's going to be a much more difficult thing.
There's even a question whether the supplemental insurance will be allowed in some people.
Yeah, it's going to be a much more difficult thing. It's going to be a question where not only are many people not going to be able to afford the supplemental coverage and what that supplemental coverage is going to cover, but again, as Maria says, that some people may or may not be able to have it at all. This was supposed to be a centerpiece of the Bush campaign for re-election. You know, he made this promise to fix Medicare, and by gosh, it's fixed. Well, as seniors are now finding out, it is they who have been fixed, or the fix is in, maybe is a better way of looking at it, given that it's Bush's buddies in the drug and insurance industries, both of which are heavy contributors to the Republican Party, and you can see why. Those are the folks that are benefiting, and seniors are not dumb. They've been around for a lot of years, and they're discovering that this president has put them squarely in the financial hole. It's really alarming. But from the angle of the impact on the economy and the cost to the government, it's just one more cost that's going to be, unless it's somehow fixed or reined in, is going to be passed on to our grandkids and their grandkids. Because, I mean, you know, $100 billion here, $100 billion there, and eventually you're starting to run into real numbers.
One thing that the Bush administration should remember, too, is that seniors vote in much higher numbers than just about any other portion of the population. And as they begin to figure out that this Medicare bill was a racket, they're going to be looking at the Democrats to see if there isn't something there that's a little bit better than what's in the White House right now. Now, the deficit this week, the Bush administration is drafting their new budget for 2005, and some of those preliminary numbers were released. As part of the process, they had to take a look at what the deficit was going to be this coming year. And it's set to balloon from $375 billion this past year to $520 billion in 2004, which is above what they had estimated what it would be. Former estimates had said somewhere around $400 billion this year.
And this is fairly consistent with past White House lowball type estimates of what the budget is going to look like. Yeah, this White House.
This White House. Bush so far has presided over annual spending growth that's higher than anything since the Lyndon Johnson years when we were mired in Vietnam and were spending on that war. Now, defense spending under his budget...
With the war on poverty at the same time.
There's
no social spending component to this. Almost none of this is actually spending money on domestic programs.
Right. Defense spending is set to rise by 7%. Homeland security spending is going to go up by 10%. But basic services, which make up about 20% of the federal budget, that includes everything from taking care of our national parks to increasing food inspections, something that we pretty desperately need here. That's set to rise by 1% or less. So not even keeping up with the rate of inflation in this new budget.
Now,
some of the programs that are at risk of being deeply cut or not funded at all include things like a six-year authorization of funds for mass transit and highway construction and maintenance that's coming up for a vote in Congress, federal higher education funding's coming up for renewal this year, and this is at a time when most state colleges have raised their tuition rates by double digits. Including here in Washington.
And the No Child Left Behind Act that Bush pushed through Congress being called one of the biggest unfunded mandates in federal history.
That's exactly right. States are being forced to test students at increasing rates and are being told that they have to hire more teachers, but they're not being given any federal money at all, hardly any federal money at all, and there's almost none budgeted in this new Bush budget. Now, there's also the question of Medicare and Social Security. That makes up a very large portion of the federal budget. And by 2008, baby boomers are going to start retiring and start drawing on those Social Security and Medicare benefits.
You're Jennifer Dunn.
Yeah. That's only 4 years away, folks, and we haven't done anything at all to prepare for that crisis. And that's not to mention Bush's other little things he wants to fund, like manned space flight and permanent tax cuts that are set to expire in 2010.
And we should also point out that a significant element that was left out of the federal budget presented to Congress entirely is the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right.
The White House is saying once again, well, we have no idea how much it's going to cost. And so what they will do is present it in a supplemental spending bill, which is, again, much It opens up the president to less scrutiny in time for the election, basically, I think is the calculation.
That's been the modus operandi of this whole Bush administration, is to avoid any kind of scrutiny for the money that's being spent in Afghanistan and Iraq. There's very little accounting being kept of where the money's going, what it's being spent on, what taxpayers are getting for it. And, of course, as Jobs said, the costs for the Iraq war are not included in any of the budget bills that are being presented to Congress. So they're always presented as supplemental bills, additional spending bills that have very few details attached to them.
Yeah. And whereas, you know, a year ago, it was a fair statement to say, well, we have no idea what's going to happen in Iraq. You know, it's a war going in where, you know, we could be in Baghdad in 2 weeks. It could take several months. We just, and even then that was kind of questionable because, you know, a number of costs of the operation are pretty fixed. But at the same time, that doubt is essentially removed at this point. We've been in Baghdad for 9 months. We know that we're facing a guerrilla insurgency. We know what that insurgency looks like, and that we can even budget in for that increasing over the next year, which is not what the Bush administration is claiming, but you can actually figure that into the budget. There is no reason for not having those estimates, as every previous administration has done, as part of the annual budget, other than political reasons.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, I also want to talk about why the deficit is a problem, because a lot of people say, including George Bush, say, well, deficits don't matter. That was actually a Dick Cheney quote.
Yeah, and by the way, it is the same people who are giving the Clinton administration holy heck in the early 90s about the ballooning federal budget deficit.
Right. Now, the reason why deficits do matter is that they have an impact not just on the U.S. economy, but on the world economy. Now, if we look at the federal deficit, we talked about this a little bit, I believe, last week or the week before, that foreign investors hold a lot of the public debt. So foreign investors buy a lot of the treasury notes and bills that are issued by the federal government to cover the federal deficit. Now, most of those foreign investors who buy those notes and bills are Chinese and Japanese investors, primarily Japanese and Chinese investors. Now, they look at and they buy U.S. treasuries because they're a safe investment, and because they're a guaranteed return on their money. So there's always an interest rate that will be paid. It's not like a stock that will go up and down in value and you might lose your principal. However, interest rates have been so low in the United States that the return is very small. And so a lot of foreign investors have been looking abroad for not necessarily a safer investment, but something that gives them a return on their investment that's a little bit better than inflation. And so what they've been doing is they've been investing in places like Southeast Asia. The Asian economies have been growing, just about the only place in the world that has been showing some regular growth.
Yeah, and now, China as well.
And China is one of those places. Now, Chinese banks are very, very unstable. There have been a number of bank failures in China. And there were economists at the World Economic Forum last week who were talking a lot about what they see as a bubble in the Southeast Asian economy, particularly in China and some of the smaller economies. And if that bubble bursts, it could set off another worldwide what did we have? We had a worldwide economic depression starting in 1997 when the Asian economy pretty much sunk because of land speculation and high levels of debt in places like Thailand and Malaysia and Hong Kong, et cetera.
Yeah, and China was pretty much exempt from that wave.
Because they were isolated from the economic community.
They were isolated.
They're not anymore.
Yeah, they're now in the WTO. There's much more international presence in terms of the manufacturing base in China, as you can see whenever you've bought anything plastic recently. And the kind of controls that can prevent against that kind of bubble really are not in place there. China is really one of the only countries in the world that has been showing large economic growth in terms of GNP over the past several years. And as a consequence, a lot of money has gone into China, and a lot of it's at risk now.
Now, also the reason why it's been showing a lot of growth is because of consumer spending and because of spending by the Chinese government. This is true for a lot of the Asian economies, not just China. There's very high public debt throughout the region. The IMF estimates it's an average of about 70% of the gross domestic product of these nations is now public debt. What happens when the U.S. deficit increases and increases and increases and investors start to look elsewhere for investments is that U.S. interest rates have to increase in order to attract investors to buy treasury notes and bills. When U.S. interest rates go up, that means the interest rates on the public debt of foreign nations go up. It makes it much harder for these companies for these countries, as well as companies that are heavily in debt, to pay off their debts and to pay the interest to service their debts. When that happens, you start an economic collapse. And that's what these economists at the World Economic Forum were worried about, and that's one big reason why the U.S. deficit is a problem, particularly right now. We could be headed into another scenario like in 1997, which you could argue was the beginning of what toppled our house of cards here in the United States in 1999 and 2000, started back in 1997 in Southeast Asia. Now, we're not even in the same kind we don't have the same kind of supports that we had in 1999. We're in a much worse position right now with our economy. If we start another worldwide economic meltdown, it could be very, very serious. So that's one reason why deficits do matter.
All right. Briefly, if we could touch upon there was a continuing hearings this week on the 9/11 Commission.
Well, not so much hearings. There's a controversy that has come up over the 9/11 Commission. They did have public hearings this week. There's part of a series, but the original legislation that started the Keene Commission, that this is bipartisan 10-member board that's looking into the causes of 9/11 was set to the legislation specified that they were set to have their final a report by mid-May of this year. I believe it was May 11th. Unfortunately, because there was so much controversy around the beginning of that commission, first the White House opposing the commission itself, then trying to name Henry Kissinger as the chair, a bunch of stonewalling that's gone on in terms of the White House refusing to hand over documents that it deemed essential to national security, because, of course, the president's daily briefings, among other things, are considered classified documents. The White House has fought this entire process to and nail. And now, because of all of those impediments over the last couple of years, the commission is saying it needs more time. It will not have enough time to finish the different public hearings that it wants to hold. There's something like 300 witnesses still to interview, including all the Bush administration officials that you would expect and some former Clinton administration officials as well. They're saying they need more time. The families of 9/11 victims are saying these folks need more time. And the White House and Dennis Hastert, Speaker of the House, at the bidding of the White House, are saying no more time. You know, let's move on. We're tired of looking at this. Even though 9/11 as a vehicle for policy change has been the cornerstone of the Bush administration. Every time Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld or anybody opens their mouth, it's we need to do this because of we don't want to have another 9/11 and the victims of 9/11 and 9/11 taught us and blah blah blah. Well, 9/11 could teach us an awful lot more if there were, as you would expect with any important event in which the government had a role in this country, if there were some independent investigation into how it happened, how something like that could be prevented from happening again. The White House is very fearful of the impact such a report would have on the re-election chances of President Bush. The original compromise that was supposed to be in the works was, we'll give you an extension if the report doesn't come out until December, which would be after the election. That apparently has fallen through. At this point, the White House is saying, and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives and the Republican leader of the House are saying, no extension. We don't want to know everything there is to know about 9/11 because it could reflect badly on our fearless leader. It really is an outrage when you consider what has been perpetrated over the last 3 years, based on 2.5 years, based on what happened in 9/11.
All right, and finally, this week in Iraq, what's going on there?
I want to start by going over the death toll. 19 U.S. soldiers died or went missing in action this week. The death toll breaks down as follows. One soldier was killed by a rocket-propelled grenade on Sunday in Baiji. Four are dead or missing from two helicopter crashes, one last Saturday and one on Sunday. Three were killed by a suicide car bomb at a checkpoint in Qaldiyah on Saturday. And 11 were killed this week by various roadside bombs. Now, what makes the roadside bombs so deadly? Why do they account for such a high percentage of the death toll? Partially because they're extremely hard to find. There's lots of scrap metal and lots of burned-out cars and military vehicles left by the side of the roads in Iraq, particularly in the Sunni Triangle, and that makes it very hard to use metal detectors to find these roadside bombs. Now, the parts are everywhere in Iraq. Heavy artillery shells, blaster caps, batteries, from motorcycle batteries to car batteries. Remote detonation also means that they're deadlier than mines because someone has their finger on the switch waiting for U.S. troops to pass by. The most common switches are garage door openers and cell phones. Bombers can use the cell phones to dial up a second phone that's attached to the battery on the bomb and therefore detonate it, which means that it's also extremely hard to catch the guys who are doing it, which is why U.S. troops almost never catch the bombers, although after they're bombed, they often open fire on whoever's standing nearby. This week, one of the Iraqi civilians who was killed was an agricultural department employee, who was shot when U.S. troops just randomly opened fire after a roadside bombing. Now,
one of the other types of behavior that has led the Iraqis to really love American soldiers.
Right. That's right.
Because it's happened all too much.
The death of civilians when U.S. troops are hit by roadside bombs is often caused by U.S. soldiers firing randomly after the explosion. Now, these bombs are planted on a lot of the main supply routes and the main patrol routes all throughout the Sunni Triangle, because it's very, very easy to tell which roads will need to be used by U.S. heavy vehicles. The troops that are trying to defuse the bombs say that they have had little or no training in how to deal with improvised explosives like this. They've had to fall back on U.S. Army manuals from the Vietnam War that tell them how to deal with booby traps and other devices. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what they're facing in Iraq over there right now. Also this week, the Financial Times of London reported that U.S. combat deaths have risen sharply in January, even though the number of guerrilla attacks has actually gone down.
Now, which I believe I was saying last week.
But yeah, which you were saying last week, but I had not actually heard that. And this week, in particular, with the death of 19 troops, it's made it particularly clear that some 36 U.S. soldiers were killed by hostile fire in January versus 24 in December, which means the attackers are becoming much more efficient and much better at what they're doing, and U.S. troops are not able to deal with that. That's pretty obvious. This week as well, David Kaye, the former head of the Iraq Survey Group, resigned his post, and he made a couple of very interesting statements to a Senate panel when he testified at a Senate hearing this week. He said that U.S. intelligence leading up to the war was deeply flawed, and he called for an independent investigation of the weapons of mass destruction intelligence that led to the war. Now, an interesting thing that wasn't really reported here in the United States, but I read about it in the French press agency reports of David Kaye's testimony, is that he said that the UN inspections were actually pretty successful at getting Saddam Hussein to disarm. That UNSCOM, and here I've got the quote right here, the direct quote is, "I think UNSCOM deserves a considerable amount of credit for disarming and destroying Iraq's arsenal."
And this is completely opposite to what Kaye was saying when he was originally brought in to do the job close to a year ago. He was very hawkish, very critical of the UN agencies.
Mm-hmm. It's a complete reversal.
Yeah. Another very interesting report that came out this week, and it was in the British press but not the U.S. press, is you have President Bush finally acknowledging that there has been discrepancies between what the intelligence reports and the Webb administration believed they would find going into Iraq, and what they have actually found. Now, the party line, and Kay followed this party line pretty much, was to blame the intelligence agencies rather than, in the memorable words of the BBC incident, sexed up reports and politicized findings. But nonetheless, this is a first for President Bush. He has not been acknowledging previously that they, you know, it's like Cheney. They've been keeping the faith that someday some of these weapons will be found, and they were right all along. This could be seen as quite the concession, but it wasn't really reported in the U.S. press. I found it in, I believe it was The Guardian in the British press.
That's right. And the interesting thing is in Britain, they're looking at this and saying, gosh, you know, we should be doing an investigation. Parliament's saying we should be doing an investigation here of how this intelligence was drawn up, where it came from, how come it was seized on and promoted and led us into this war. And now it turns out that almost none of it was true. Here in the U.S., however, the House and Senate intelligence committees are supposed to be doing the same kind of thing, looking at the intelligence and how it was cobbled together and drawn up, where it came from, what the sources were, et cetera, and who pushed it and took us into war. Now, because the Republicans control the House and the Senate, there's been pretty heavy partisan bickering. It's also an election year. They want to make sure that none of this falls. The Republicans want to make sure none of this falls onto George Bush during an election year. And so the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are pretty much stymied right now. They're not getting anywhere in any kind of an investigation. And David Kaye said this week that there ought to be an independent investigation. And he's right. This is an instance wherein an independent investigation is absolutely necessary.
Yeah. And it comes back to accountability once again around this, around 9/11, around the incident of the leaking of Joseph Wilson's wife's name. All of these things demand accountability from the White House that we're simply not seeing.
Seems like they're getting a little closer to a minor bit of accountability over in the UK, though, with BBC and stuff.
Yeah.
That's been
Although the Hutton report's been pretty widely viewed by the public and a number of lawmakers over there as a whitewash, as an exoneration of Blair that really wasn't deserved.
It was very limited, too. It looked only at the issues that surrounded the death of David Kelly. Didn't really look at where the intelligence information came from and the sources and how it was put together.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons for the whitewash. Incidentally, that topic came up, as did a number of others. Joseph Wilson, the man whose wife was outed as the CIA agent, the former ambassador who was sent to Africa and debunked the yellow cake theory, et cetera, we've talked about. He is coming to town next week. He will be at McCaw Hall as part of their American Voices series. I had a chance to interview him on Wednesday, and that transcript of that interview, the full transcript, will be up at workingforchange.com on Monday. And I think a more limited version will be in Seattle Weekly this week also.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It is a community-based newspaper that comes out a couple times, twice every other week. It's covering global and local issues, and you can find it free of charge at bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free newspapers, or on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And because those of us who write for it and edit for it, et cetera, are all volunteers, we are always looking for both more money to print the paper and more volunteers to help put it out. If you have inklings along those lines, or if you have feedback on anything you see in the paper or here on this program, we're always happy to hear from you. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.